Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Don't worry, it's the Savage Nation. Stay with me. Trust, you're not on the wrong station. Just listen, I'll tell you why. Oh mio, babino, caro. You are listening to the most remarkable voice I have heard in my adult life. It's a 10-year-old child named Jackie Evancho. And I saw her Saturday night at the Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's incredible facility here. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, this 10-year-old child, it was like a show, you know, and they do an amateur thing and they met her on the road and this and that. So you see this beautiful young child come out, you figure she's going to be, you know, a good amateur. And you kind of tolerate, you want to be nice to children, you know, figure it's going to be like a high-end school play type of thing, and you're just going to be polite. When she opened up and she started to sing, I couldn't believe what I was listening to. I thought it was a lip sync, number one. Then I saw, no, it was live, number two. And when she was singing Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro, which is Oh My Dear Papa, I had tears coming to my eyes. She moved me so much, and I said to myself, I am looking at a prodigy. I am looking at the birth of a prodigy in front of my own eyes, and I started to think about something, which is child prodigies. Because we live in an age where the loser gets all of the attention. We live in an age where the idiot is held up as the role model. We live in an age when the moron is held up as the genius. We live in an age when the drug addict and treatment facilities seem to be the norm amongst the Hollywood slime. And rarely do we see the prodigies anymore, because all of the money goes for the bottom end rather than the top end. And that's why the society is dying, amongst other reasons. And that's why China's leader can come here and basically make a mockery of this nation, because they have so dumbed this country down. So when I saw and heard, rather, this genius, Jackie Evancho, 10 years old, remember now, singing was stirred beyond anything I had seen in entertainment. Now remember, I'm a performing artist. You say talk show host, you can say, well, you can call me anything you want. But when you've been doing it as long as I have for over 16 years, and you have the third largest audience in the United States of America in talk radio, you have to understand that a lot of this is performing art. Whether or not it's taught at the High School of Performing Art is irrelevant. What's relevant is that talk radio, despite the fact that it's smeared by the vermin on the left, is a performing art. And so, as I say to you, when I see a 10-year-old with this phenomenal capacity for performance, I started to think about prodigies in general. And I said, all I could think of is how hard it must be to be a prodigy and how hard it must be to raise a child prodigy. You may think, oh, how wonderful it would be to have a child so gifted. How great it would be to wake up in the morning or listen to that child sing to you at night. But, you know, this follows on the heels of why Chinese mothers are superior. Remember I read that article to you last week on the Savage Nation? I saw the article about how the Chinese mothers, particularly this one that I was reading about, drills the child like a drill sergeant, makes them cry and makes them come up to the standards that she expects of them. The opposite of what American mothers do today, which is indulge the child and worry more about their self-esteem than about their performance. And so, as I say, I asked myself how hard it must be to raise a real prodigy in the society that we're living in. And then I looked into this whole issue of prodigies, and I saw an old study on intelligence, and it was done back in the 1920s, believe it or not, where a psychologist, Lewis Terman, tracked 1,500 supposedly gifted child prodigies throughout their whole lives. And he found that starting life gifted was no guarantee of success. Many prodigies floundered when they reached adulthood. Now, that's not so unusual, is it? We know it happens an awful lot where people go off the rails, right? I'm going to ask you something on the Savage Nation amongst all of the news stories. Were you yourself a child prodigy who kind of went off the rails or went wrong? Or did you know a child prodigy who basically did not succeed as an adult? I thought it's an interesting topic because I myself was not a child prodigy in anything. I was very much like Darwin or Einstein in that I was a very ordinary student. In fact, in some areas, I was not even a good student. I was too much of a dreamer myself. And people thought that, well, he'll never amount to anything. Well, you know, 28 books later and a doctorate from Berkeley and a successful career as an author and a broadcaster. And I'm not boasting. I'm telling you, nobody would have predicted this when I was a child except those who believed in me. And that would you can count probably on two people on the back of your hand. So you can't always tell what an adult is going to be by looking at the child. You can see a prodigy at 10 singing like this, and I pray to God she becomes as famous as any diva has ever become. But I'm asking you, is this a topic you're interested in? If not, we'll move on, okay? Because I can move on. Because today we have a lot of news, even though half the country is on vacation because they work for the U.S. government or the state government or the local government or their own government, and they don't work on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. God bless Martin Luther King Jr. He's done so much for so many people. But I still must tell you that I'm a little put off by the fact that we've lost George Washington's birthday by name and Abraham Lincoln's birthday by name. Instead, they've been bunched together in President's Day. While there's only one holiday named for a man, and that man is Martin Luther King Jr. Now, I have nothing to say negative about Martin Luther King Jr. He had his flaws like all human beings. But why should there be a name for him, named holiday for a man, when there's no name for Washington or Lincoln? I've asked year after year. So you say, well, he's done so much for civil rights, and I would agree with you. And that's why I say this should be named Civil Rights Day. But I don't even want to talk about that. I've made the point before. And, you know, you want to name, you want to call me names, you can do that. But it doesn't matter what you say about me, because I know who I am. I don't need you to define me. And speaking of race and speaking of days, yesterday I had at my home probably the finest man I've ever had in my home. I'm a reclusive personality. I don't have guests in my home very often, if at all. I tend to be a loner, family only, me, the dog, and whoever will put up with me in the family once or twice a year. But yesterday I actually entertained, which for me was once in 10 years. I had Colonel Allen West over and his wife and his two teenage daughters. And I got to tell you something. When you meet an extraordinary individual, as I did yesterday, you realize how incredibly blessed America is to have had Colonel Allen West, 22 years in the military. Then he comes out of the military and they try to frame him for doing his job. Remember what happened to him? They wanted to throw him in jail for 8 years like Lieutenant Behenna and Colonel Chassani. Remember what we went through here together with me backing Chassani till he was exonerated with your help? I sent the money. You sent the money. We raised the public awareness. The Thomas More Law Center did their job. And Chassani was freed of all lying charges. Well, now we have another young man riding in Fort Leavenworth. And his name is Lieutenant Behenna. And it's funny I'm mentioning it because I stopped talking about it. But, you know, Colonel West was at my house. It's Congressman West, really, now. He won a huge upset victory. And we talked about it in great detail. Huge upset victory. He ran in a liberal area of South Florida, and the vermin here smeared him every which way to Sunday. He is a real war hero, and these rats on the left, these Democrat rats, smeared him every way they could with lies that you can't believe. But he overcame them. And he told us a lot yesterday. He's a quiet gentleman, and he has the bearing of a military officer. And his family, as I say, is wonderful. I knew the teenage daughters would like to swim, so they went swimming in the pool most of the time. And we, the adults, sat around boringly talking about everything in the universe, mainly about race in America and elections in America and politics in America. And most importantly and interestingly to me, most important to me was, how did you, an African-American man, Congressman West, win in an overwhelmingly white liberal district of South Florida? And he told me some very interesting tales from the campaign trail. that are extremely important for you to hear. If the conservative movement, whatever is left of it in this country, is to ever see a renaissance, and it will, because no matter what the media is saying to you, forget all of the pink shirts in the Republican Party. They always were. They always will be bought and sold by K Street. They're not the future of America. Unless the truly conservative wing of America has a phenomenal renaissance and is permitted to rise despite all of the blockage by the Republicans, we are going to have an outright communist government in this country within 10 years. Because right now we have a Leninist Marxist as president named Barack Obama. That's my opinion. And you say, wow, how could you say that? Well, I wrote a best-selling book on it. Why don't you read the book before you open your big trap? Before you open your big trap, your life preserver mouth, why don't you read the evidence, moron, instead of telling me what you read in your local newspaper or saw on your television? We have a Leninist Marxist president, which is why we had a counter-revolution at the ballot box last October. You understand what I'm saying to you? And now, of course, they're being triangulated and compromised by the K Street gang in the Republican Party, the pink shirts, I call them. So look, we have a lot to talk about. Prodigies is very interesting to me. Because, you know, I want to go back on that for a minute. Play her voice for a minute again. Just play the child again, because when I heard it, Jackie Evancho. Ten-year-old girl with this voice. Wait, you hear her hit a high note. Bring it to the high note. And it was a beautiful crowd of people there at Mar-a-Lago. I got to tell you, it wasn't a crowd at a rap concert. Let me put it to you that way. I'll be right back. Savage.
Even Monday, got to work, flag or sleeve on me. He'll come to
Welcome back to the Prodigal Son on radio, Michael Savage. Slow start in life. And here we are. So I don't know what it'd be like if I was a prodigy as a kid. Must have been murder. What if you're a poor parent with a prodigy for a child? Now, there are the stage mother, for example. But, you know, they can both wind up crazy from it. There's almost something quite ludicrously pathetic about the stage mother. You think of a variety of that condition with JonBenet Ramsey, God rest her soul, a little child wound up, you know, strangled to death in the basement. That was they made her into a monkey with the dresses and then. But I'm talking about something other than a beautiful child. I'm talking about a child who has more than surface beauty. And I'm not underestimating the value of surface beauty. I'm a man who loves beauty in all forms, whether it be a bird or be a human. But I'm talking about a gifted child. I'm talking about physicist Isaac Newton. I'm talking about double Nobel Prize winner Marie Curie. I'm talking about composer Felix Mendelssohn. I'm talking about a violin genius and conductor Yehudi Menuhin. But what about child prodigies whose stars crash like an asteroid? Do we know about them? And of course, not all geniuses start out at an early age with the word prodigy. Charles Darwin and Albert Einstein became brilliant scientists, but in the early on in their lives, they were considered stupid. Particularly Einstein, they used to box his ears. He was dumb. He was staring off into space because his mind was out there in the perimeters of the universe, somewhere the teacher couldn't go, okay? So here we are, 10-year-old girl sings Saturday night at the Mar-a-Lago, and I figured, all right, you know, she's just going to be a kid singer, and I'm going to be polite. And I had to stand up. I was awed by her. And when she hit those high notes, I'm repeating myself now, I didn't have a dry eye. There wasn't a dry eye in the audience amongst the men. Now, the trophy wives don't move. Nothing moves them. It was filled with bald guys who made their fortune either in the garment center or in real estate with the third wives. The second wife, they probably called the plaintiff. The plaintiff wives were not there already. They were up to the trophy wives, a minimum 3 decades or younger than them. And the wives were, when this 10-year-old girl came out, there wasn't the grown women were probably so jealous just by how she looked. You know, in our society, the younger, I know, really, the women got rigid and uptight. Because no matter how beautiful you are at 35 or 40, how can you compete? I'm just a social observer, pardon me. So I observed that the men were moved by the child, that the women were rigid with envy. But it was a phenomenal thing, and it brought me to already out of time already. Boom. And see, this is a short segment into the show. I'm into a set stop here at the end of this segment, and then I can't go on and develop. But in there, and we come back, I can develop and develop and develop and develop like an expanding universe. Were you or did you know someone who was a child prodigy who did not succeed well as an adult is the question for now. So I'm going to take one quick call. Okay, Rick in New York, fire away. 1 minute or less. Go ahead.
I was a math prodigy. I was multiplying 3, 4, 5-digit numbers in my head faster than my math teacher could do on the board. However, family structure was not there. I had a father who was basically psycho, beat us. Like, nowadays, they lock people up for a lot less than what was done to us.
Right. Right. No, you do need a family structure. And you would have been better off with a passive father than an aggressive, let us say, jealous, competitive father.
This was beyond competitive jealous. This was psycho, literally.
Oh, he was a psycho, bad guy. Well, all right, so that killed your talent.
You end up worrying about staying alive, literally, more than you do about developing.
Well, hold on now, but Rick, hold on. You just touched on something even more interesting to me, and I hope to my listeners. Did the fact that your father was a nut, and he didn't let you develop as a math prodigy, but instead you diverted yourself into survival, did that help you in life, your survival abilities?
Interestingly, I joined the Marines at 18, worked intelligence my whole time in the military. I'm retired.
Bingo.
I'm now an engineer.
So, but your father, in a strange way, did you a favor. Otherwise, you'd just be an accountant somewhere who could run numbers. I'll be right back.
Savage.
We are talking about a hidden topic in America, a topic rarely discussed in the new America where the loser, the drug addict, and the bum, not to mention the illegal alien, is glorified as the new man. Come on, play it up. 10-year-old child, Jackie Evancho. So I heard it Saturday night, and I said, I'm going to repeat it again. I couldn't believe this voice. O'Neill Babino Caro, and I'm standing there saying, I've just seen a force of nature, and people didn't know what I was talking about. I said, she's a force of nature. She's a prodigy. And with proper handling, she's going to be one of the great divas. And I hope it's true. But then I started to think about prodigies who've gone off the rails. And that's what we're talking about, the two sides of genius. Because there's not only one side to genius, there are two sides. And we live in a society that emphasizes the loser. The loser is held up as the role model. And I don't have to repeat myself again. And there's almost no money for the genius child. When I was a kid, and I got to remind you of this, there were varieties of high school programs. There was the academic track at Jamaica High School, the commercial track for those who wanted to go into like business or accounting or whatever. And then there was the trade school where the kids learned to do something. They didn't like math and all that. So they had a whole school for kids who learned how to be carpenters and plumbers and electricians. And God, did we need them. Take a look now. Where are the carpenters and plumbers and electricians coming from? Mexico. And God bless them. Most of the mechanics who know how to fix a car today come from Mexico, where they still have trade schools. But aside from that, aside from the three tracks in high schools, we had another track. The troublemaking bum. The kid who punched a teacher. The kid who wouldn't sit still in school. In other words, that bum from Arizona who wouldn't shut his mouth. He would have been thrown out of school in elementary school, where some of them were very tough, and they liked to get physical. So they usually brought in teachers who's around. Usually the kids listen. And if the kid didn't listen, they put him into a reform school. And if they didn't listen, then they became a politician. If they wouldn't listen to anybody, then they went right into politics directly. So you get the picture. But on top of that, On top of what I've just described to you of the school system itself, I want to tell you something else. I was telling people about the kind of teachers I had as a kid. It's a little off the track, but it'll come back to where I was going anyway, and I'll take your calls on, were you a prodigy, what happened, or did you know a prodigy, what happened, blah, blah, blah. I had a teacher in high school who I told a lot of people about over the weekend, because I don't know, we were talking about this and that. I said I had a teacher in high school who was missing three fingers on his right hand, his chalk hand. He was Irish. Allegedly, it was from a little experience with bombs in Ireland. And we loved this guy. We loved him. He was up at the blackboard with the two fingers with the chalk. And when the tests came back, Mr. W would call you out with your test grade. He'd go like this. Martin Shapiro, 99, come up to the board. And he'd give you the 99. He'd say, good job. Then he'd go down the line. Milton Feldman, 98, come up to the board. Gloria Allred, zero. Gloria Bernstein, 97, come up to the board. Now, I'm sitting there because I wasn't a particularly good geometry student. I know I had like a 78 or whatever. And I was dreading when he was run down the list till he got up. The petition was so severe. You talk about a Chinese mother. I'm not Chinese, but I may as well have been Chinese by the way I was raised to perform. So when he got under the 80s already, you were turning pink because you knew what was coming. So you get up to you got a 75 or whatever. All right, Milton Prima, come up to the board. And Prima would come up and he'd look at you in front of the whole class and he would insult you. He wouldn't call you a name. He'd say, now what happened to you? How come you only got a 74? And the kid would be red-faced, humiliated, right? And his poor self-esteem would suffer, wouldn't it? Well, guess what, you morons? It was the suffering of his self-esteem that made him go home and study more. Instead of telling him he was doing a good job for getting a 40. That's what they have today. You go to a Little League game, you see a kid miss a ball, and the father, good job, good job. I can't even go to the games. They miss the ball, they're klutzes, they shouldn't even have a uniform on, and he's screaming, good job, Johnny. What, everyone has to be a ball player? I don't understand the country's upside down from the way I was raised. So when I see a prodigy like this, I get excited. That's all I can say to you. So I'm asking you a question out about the prodigies. Were you a prodigy, blah, blah, blah? What happened to you? Because people do go off the rails. I think this is an interesting show. And I want to know why in this society. Oh, I was getting to another point. So let me just finish it. So in my time in school, there were different grades of kids, in other words, mentally, IQs. They gave you IQ tests, right? My IQ was 170. It was an off-the-charts IQ, but I was a terrible student because I couldn't memorize. I didn't like memorizing, but I could figure things out if they left me alone. It was only later on in graduate school when I had a great professor who said to me, I'm not going to require you to spit back what's in a book. He said, all I need you to know is where to look for the information. That's what he said to me. See, he understood what an intelligent mind needed. An intelligent mind didn't need facts sitting in his head. There were a lot of kids, mind you, who could memorize this and memorize that, and they usually became, in some cases, the doctors or the lawyers. I'm not trying to mock that. We certainly have some great doctors and lawyers who are both brilliant and great memorizers, but unfortunately, a lot of kids were simply great memorizers, and they became automatons in their fields. Anyway, there was a thing in my school in those days, a whole program called SP, Special Progress. What does that mean? If you were considered bright, they would let you skip the eighth grade and you went to a special school, an SP class, where you skipped the eighth grade and you did seventh and ninth in a junior high, and then you went into high school. Now, here's something interesting for you to know. I went into school to begin with when I was five because of my birthday. It had nothing to do with intelligence, just the luck of the birthday, right? And I was not a tall kid. So right away, I was 5 years old and on the smaller side in a very mean, tough, horrible neighborhood. Now I get through the SP, and the teacher says to my mother, she says, Mrs. Savage, before you decide whether or not Michael should go into the SP class, I want you to think through this carefully. Because if he does, he's going to enter high school as a sophomore, and he's only going to be 13 years old, and he's going to be a kid among some kids who are 18 years old, and he may not be able to emotionally handle the results. We didn't even pay any attention to that. We just did it because it was considered a big deal. But you know something? Looking back, I wish I didn't skip the eighth grade. But the point is, in other words, there's a lot to be said for not skipping grades if you're pretty bright or you're a good test taker. Because there's an emotional development in a child as well as an intellectual development. That's a separate story unto itself. I just wanted to share it with you. And one last detail on all of this. I look at school budgets today. Do you know how much money goes for English as a second language? How many billions are being wasted on illegal immigrants who can't speak English? And we have to have the whole class slowed down, the whole curriculum slowed down for them. I never heard of a country that's so upside down. You want me to renovate things? I can renovate them. I have so many great ideas. That's why you buy my books. You want to renovate the school system, save billions of dollars? Real easy. Eliminate English as a second language. If the kid wants to learn English, let him learn English. Heard of anything like it? My father came over as an immigrant from Russia. They didn't have Russian as a second language. Either he learned English in 2 minutes, or they would have pushed him to the back of the class as a dummy. So he didn't want to be a dummy, so he learned English. And the mother said, speak English or you'll never amount to anything in the world. That's the way it was. Learn English, learn English, learn English. No, now, and have to give you a tutor in your bedroom at night. The whole world is upside down, which is why China's coming here and laughing at us. Why the currency is debased. Why the manufacturing, they can't even add 13 and 43. Jeff in New York on WOR, thanks for listening. You're on the show. What's on your mind?
Dr. Savage, a pleasure. My wife actually is from Chile, from South America, and she is actually very similar to this young girl. She actually was a child in opera, actually a very big prodigy.
Right.
As a kid. She actually, as a young kid, she actually got scholarships right from the get-go.
Right.
When she was 14, actually, Plácido Domingo. Actually went to South America for a competition.
And what happened? Did she thrive, or did it come to an end?
No, she thrived. She actually, if you care to hear, my mother-in-law actually grabbed my wife's hand as a kid at 14, back behind the stage, and right before Plácido Domingo was ready to walk out the door, asked if she could do an audition right on the spot.
The stage mother gave her the start because she asked him, and he said yes.
He said, well, go ahead and sing. Right there on the spot, she belted out an area. He gave her a scholarship right on the spot. At 15, not even a year later, she spent the next 5 years in Europe singing with a full scholarship all over Europe. At 17, she was singing professionally, and they just crushed her. They abused the voice. She was making a ton of money. And at that point, she just couldn't take it. She quit, went back to her, back to Chile. 4 years later.
She left you?
No. I'm sorry?
She left you alone here?
No. I'm married to her now. We've been together.
Oh, well, that's a great story, Jeff. Thank you for that. Another they abuse. Well, it's like a racehorse. Is there anything more sad that breaks a person's heart more than to see an incredibly beautiful, gorgeous thoroughbred break a leg on a track and then they have to shoot it or euthanize it? Does that not rip your guts out? And you ask yourself, why does such an amazing animal break a leg? The answer is simple. They breed the horses for speed without regard to the weight that the animal is bearing on his feet, and the bones break. You ask any trainer, they're pushing the horses beyond their capacity, and the horse breaks a leg, in plain English. The horses were not made to be bred like this and to run like that. In other words, they're pushing them too hard, which is an interesting side note for children. You could have a thoroughbred child, and I must disagree with that Chinese lady who says, do this, insult them. You could push them a little too hard, too, and you could break them. Never mind a leg. You break a heart, you can't heal it. I remember when I was a kid in New York, I used to go from one street to the next, from the Bowery to Harlem. I don't think there's a street in Manhattan I didn't walk in when I was a kid. I was an inveterate Manhattan walker. I remember there was a shop on 86th Street, a little tiny store. That's the part of New York I used to love, the older New York. I don't even know if it exists anymore. You could see little stores in Germantown. That's all gone already. It's yuppified, whatever. And the store said it was, we fix everything but broken hearts, okay? I never forgot that. It was beautiful. But you can break a prodigy's heart, too. You could push the child too far, and you could break the child. Or you could yell at the child too much and break the child. You could drive the child crazy and drive the child into drugs. So this is the challenge for a society and for the individual parent. How do you raise a child to begin with? That's number one. But the biggest challenge is how do you raise a really special child who's a genius? We have all sorts of programs for children who are, you can't use the word anymore, I'll use a word, special education. All right, we have to have sympathy for them. I had a brother who was handicapped. I only wish to God that they had then what they have now. I don't think he would have been sent away to a home because I pretty much know that they could have brought this kid back to some functional level. In those days, they threw him on the trash heap of life, and for 20 years he suffered in a mental hospital until he died there. I don't even want to go into it. The horrors are beyond belief. It's one of the reasons I keep working. I've told you this before. What motivates me? I have two hearts and two minds beating in my body. One is for me and one is for my brother who never lived, Jerome. So I do it for him in a way. Like I have to lead his life as well. And so you say, well, it's just a metaphor. Take it any way you want. You know what I'm saying? I do have to lead that double life. I have to have one life for me and one life for the boy who never came out, the silent brother. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of subtleties in genius, and there's a lot of subtleties in kids who are unfortunately born with a chemical deficiency or enzymatic deficiency or genetic deficiency or physical handicaps. Yes, of course we need to help them. But when a society only helps them, what happens to the geniuses is the question. Pittsburgh, PA. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
What's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
I'd like to say that I was one of those children when I was growing up. I did well in school. I got concepts right now. It was really great, and I was really smart, and I knew it, and I didn't have to work that hard. And then I got to college, and I just hit a wall, and that was it.
What do you mean by hit a wall? Explain.
Well, I couldn't compete anymore. I couldn't compete. I wasn't successful. I didn't understand what the teachers wanted. I wasn't dishing it out. And my health was bad, too. I got arthritis. And so everything just...
What, you got RA?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. Terrible illness comes on from stress in many cases, by the way.
Well, yeah. I want to tell you another thing. I bought Trickle Up Poverty new. I never buy books new. And I also want to tell you that it's probably a compliment to you that you were banned in Britain.
Oh, that's sweet. Stephanie, thank you. From one genius to another, thank you. Well, then there's the prodigy hits college, and then all of a sudden you have the sexuality issue, which can take anyone off the rails. They could become obsessed. You know, we can go into this in many different ways. A fascinating topic that can't be done in 2 minutes or less. Let me put it to you in a delicate manner. I knew some young ladies in high school who were geniuses mentally, but they were also sexually promiscuous. I am not saying that genius and promiscuity necessarily go together, but very often they do, incidentally, is that somehow the promiscuity and the genius, for some reason, are twins. They're cousins in the same mind. There was a book years ago written, I think Norman Mailer wrote it. It was called Genius and Lust, and it was about Henry Miller. I think it was a story about Henry, but he called it Genius and Lust. It doesn't mean every genius is lustful. That's a real excuse, you know. Oh, because he's a genius, he could be a degenerate. That's not what I'm saying. But very often the kid who is extremely bright will also be extremely promiscuous. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Talking about prodigies on the Savage Nation, and this is a 10-year-old child, Jackie Evancho. I don't know her. I have no stake in her success. I just cannot believe how this woman could sing, this child could sing. And they met her just on the road, the fellow who was the head of it. He heard her during an amateur hour. He gave her an audition. Anyway, look, I made the point already. So we're talking about prodigies, prodigious, the prodigal son. Hades, Papa Doc, Baby Doc returns from exile. Can you believe this? A once feared dictator who was ousted in a popular uprising 25 years ago has made a stunning return to Haiti. I could not believe what I was reading. And I was right again. Finally, the old York Times reported on the Arizona monster that he was a pothead in the salvia attic. That's my headline. They wrote, being around people who smoke pot, they tend to be a little paranoid. No kidding. But he was also a salvia addict, disconnected from reality. But let's not get into it. What these drugs do to geniuses is different than what they do to an ordinary person. This is an interesting show topic unto itself, by the way. I've told you before I smoked marijuana in college, like everyone I knew did, except for the few nerdy kids, God bless them, they were smart enough to avoid it. I hated marijuana, what it did to me. I hated it, but I did it because it was part of the initiation rite of the crowd I was with, and also because everybody smoked it, and you're considered a schmuck if you didn't. A weakling, a loser, you weren't hip, you weren't cool. And you know, every time I smoked it, I had a paranoid reaction. My palms would sweat. I'd have a sense of reality would change. I hated the stuff. But I went along with it because I was a kid under peer pressure. And people would say to me, what's wrong with you? Why do you have paranoia from marijuana? It mellows me out. And I was saying to myself, you know what? There's a difference between a guitar and a violin. And most of the people who got mellowed out from marijuana were like a banjo with two strings. I didn't know I was a Stradivarius. You don't screw with a Stradivarius. You know what I'm saying? If you're a banjo, good. Marijuana is wonderful for you. Oh, mellow. I'll have some tequila and marijuana. I'll get really mellow. Well, good, because you got a one-string guitar, that's all. A one-string banjo, so it mellowed you out. But go try to deal with it if you're a harp, you know, or a harpsichord as a human being, or a mind like a harpsichord. You don't want to tamper with drugs if you got a harpsichord for a brain. And I want you to tell your children that. That drugs are for the banjos, not for the harpsichords amongst us. This society can only be saved by the harpsichord minds, the alphas. God bless the alphas.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Talking about prodigies today on the Savage Nation, because I'm sick and tired of talking about politicians and the political and listening to people with blackboards and such who are trying to pretend that they're geniuses. I mean, I know a prodigy when I hear one or see one. And as I say, Saturday evening I was a guest of Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And to me, this is I don't go out a lot. So for me, this is a phenomenon to have dinners and lunches. Not my style. But I know how to do it because I grew up in a different world than the one I live in. I live in creepy San Francisco, depressing, creepy, hippie San Francisco. And basically, I'm a reclusive personality because I have chosen to be withdrawn and reclusive. But I grew up in a different world. And now that I'm on the East Coast, I come here once in a while to South Florida. I'm leading a life that is almost a continuation of a life I left behind many decades ago, which is highly social, highly outgoing, and such. And it's an interesting duality in essence. I got to tell you something. One of the reasons I choose to be isolated in San Francisco, and you say, well, how can you live there? You're not like them. No, I'm not like Nancy Pelosi or Barbara Boxer. I don't know anybody there except one or two people that I talk to. Two, three, four guys I count as guys I know. I have no representation in Congress. You're telling me there's a congressperson in Northern California? No. You're telling me Boxer or Feinstein represents American values? No. So in South Florida, I have a totally different life. I have a congressman named Alan West, who he's a hero of mine. a patriotic American war hero who knows exactly what's going on, who knows the black experience inside and out. I didn't even get to that. I'll get to it maybe tomorrow, what we were talking about yesterday, how he won in an overwhelmingly white district, by the way. It's very interesting. And you say, well, it's because it was a gerrymandered district and it was largely black. It's not true. I think it's something like 14% of his district was African-American, incidentally. It was not gerrymandered for African-Americans. He went to meetings. I'm going to get off the track in a minute. He went to campaign rallies. He was the way the underdog. I'm going to lay it on the line. You know, this is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. He's African-American, so I feel somewhat empowered to talk about some of the things we said, and I hope I'm not violating any confidences. I said, how did you win in Jewish districts? And we talked about it. And he said he went to several different campaign rallies along the way. He was way, way behind. The left wing had smeared him. The local rat paper smeared him. The vermin he was running against, this rat bum who shouldn't be a dog catcher in Siberia, said things about him. He should be ashamed of himself, but a rat like that never has any shame. Anyway, he overcame it all and he wins. He says to me, well, he said, I got to tell you something. As a veteran of the military, he said, I got a lot of respect in the black community. And he said, a lot of them came up to me and they said, Colonel, you know, this was along the way. They said, Colonel, I don't like your social politics, but I like you as a person. I'm going to vote for you because they like the man. See, now that's what I'm talking about, is the character. His character shone through and it overrode party affiliation. And I think that's why Alan West won. I personally think he could go all the way, this guy. I mean, if Obama could be president, and Obama is such an America hater, God, maybe there's a chance that an African-American man who loves America could one day be president. You never know. You know what I'm saying? You never know. Maybe. Just so anyway, we talk about all the different subtleties of that, and we didn't get into the genius stuff. I mean, that's for me. But the night before, I'd gone to the Mar-a-Lago that Trump owns, and it's really an amazing. It's like the Palace of Versailles. I've never seen such an attention to detail. I got to talk about the food for a minute because I am a food person. Do you know that the food on the East Coast doesn't compare to the food on the West Coast? It's the magnitudes of betterness. I love people in San Francisco think they're foodies and they know food. They don't know food. They do not know food. It's not that it's different. The people are not as picky on the West Coast in San Francisco. L.A., yes. Yes, the L.A. people are very picky because most of them are from the East Coast of New York, and they're very demanding, and they'll send something back if it's no good. The reason the food in the Bay Area is so mediocre, by and large, is because the people are sheeple. The sheeple go in a restaurant, and they're ashamed to send anything back, even if they knew the difference, which I don't think they do. Whatever they give them, it's wonderful. They go into an Asian restaurant, they start bowing right away for a glass of water and a napkin. God forbid the guy gives them an extra glass of water, they don't know what to do. They're on their hands and knees before, thank you, thank you, thank you. They go in the Asian restaurant thanking him for even letting him eat there. The East Coast, the food's no good. They send it back. What is it you give me this garbage for? You know what I mean? Look at the shrimp. It's still moving around or whatever. So I got to tell you, the standards are higher in food quality as far as I'm concerned. So I'm having a drink, you know, the suit, the tie, which is unusual for me. And it's the appetizer drink, open bar, blah, 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 waiting for the people to come in. And I've been to all sorts of events in my life. I have never in my life been at a smorgasbord, so to speak, if you want to call it that. You have the ahi station, and you're expected, right? They had a paella station. Now, I happen to love paella. And I went over there. I said, all right, I cooked it myself. I said to the young lady behind the counter, she said, well, how is it? I said, you know what? It's very good. I said, everybody makes it differently. I said, well, how's the chef make it? She said, turn around. He's right there. He came over. I said, how do you make your paella? I have one question for you. Do you use real saffron? He said, yes, we used about, like 2 pounds of it tonight for this crowd. I said, well, okay, that's a good start because it tastes like it. As you know, saffron is super expensive. It's the pistol of a particular plant. And not talking about guns, that might be a banned word in the new America. But he said, yes, real saffron. And I said, here's the real question. Do you cook your paella with the pan covered or do you leave it open? Because a lot of the recipes say leave it open. He said, no, I cover it or else the rice won't cook. I said, so do I. So I confirmed that I know what I'm doing because I lived in Spain when I was a youth. When I was a wayward youth trying to find my way in life, I lived in Spain for a while. Great experience at the time. Anyway, it's a long way of getting back to the topic at hand. That night they had a show, and I'm not a show guy because it reminded me, when you say dinner and a show, I can't sit that long. I'm a radio talk show host. I do a three-hour show. Believe me, it's exhausting. So the idea of going to an event where it's two-hour appetizer, two-hour dinner, is almost a dead man. So when the girl came out, a 10-year-old girl, I figured, it'll be just some, you know, kid who can sing, and I'll clap, and I'll go home. Well, she stirred me, as I say to you, this child star, and I said, God, I remember what it was like to be around. Where are the prodigies, I ask myself, like this child? Where are they? Where did they go? And the answer, of course, is built in the question. A society that emphasizes the loser, the bum, the drug addict, the rehab, pays almost no attention or spends almost no money on the genius or the prodigy, and that's why we have such a wreckage in our school system. What percent of your local school budget do you think goes for English as a second language? 20%? Maybe more in California or in Texas or Florida or in New York or in Illinois. English as a second language? English is the first language, my friend. And if you're an immigrant, learn English or you're never going to make it in this country. That's the way I was raised. That's the way you should be raised. And that's what we need in our schools. End ELS across America. And right away, you could save the schools with one little move like that. Do you think there's a politician with the guts to do it? They're afraid of losing the Hispanic vote. I love how the Republicans now are catering to the Hispanic vote. They're telling us we've got to legalize illegals so we don't alienate the Hispanic vote. And I said, wait a minute, what about the Caucasian vote? Where'd that go? You already took that for granted, you idiots, you? Again, the Republicans are committing suicide again. Again, I can tell you right now, you want me to project ahead with my genius? Obama's the next president. Unless there's a miracle... Unless there is a miracle breakout candidate, you may as well count Obama in for another 4 years after this. You say, no, it can't happen. Not only will it happen, but it's supposed to happen because that's the way the structure is set up. You don't understand any of this yet. You don't understand it was 8 years of Clinton, a Democrat, then 8 years of Bush, then the next president is a Democrat for 8 years. They just swing back and forth. Dummy, don't you see the picture? So, I'm talking to you level-headed now. I'm asking you if you were a genius or a prodigy in the first question. And did you burn out? What happened to you? Or did you know someone who was a prodigy today burn out? And then I want to broaden the question to something a little different because it's something of interest to me. And it's something I've observed in my own life. And I don't know if you've observed the same thing. There was a book years ago by Norman Mailer called Genius and Lust. And it was about the writings of Henry Miller. And Henry Mailer was a fine writer himself. I didn't like his politics, but I loved his writing. And Mailer said that lust was the driving force of Henry Miller's writing and a key to his genius. I disagree, by the way, and I'll tell you why later. He then chooses substantial passages from, Henry Miller's major books in an attempt to demonstrate how Henry Miller fused the erotic, that's a word anyone can understand, the social, that's something we all understand, and the cosmic, which is a little more esoteric, to create some of the most prophetic prose to be found in the English language. You know I'm a huge fan of Henry Miller. I don't currently read him. I read him through very bad periods of my life, mainly Black Spring. I love more than any of his other books. One of the greatest books ever written because it was a combination of these elements, a combination of erotic, social, and cosmic. Read Black Spring. You'll see what I'm talking about. So it raises the question now, are you a genius? And do you struggle with sexual issues such as promiscuity? I especially would like to hear from women who are willing to open up on this. You could put, I'm serious. This is not like salacious, nor is an attempt to titillate the audience. It's really an attempt to understand something that is never discussed anymore whatsoever, period. It's buried. I'll be right back. Savage. We're going to take a couple of callers right now on the issue we've been talking about in the Savage Nation. You talk about incompetence, the opposite of the prodigy. You may assume that Obama's a prodigy. I think he's the dumbest president in American history, and I'll tell you why. Any man who would cater to China at a time when China's on the rise like this is a dumb man. Any man who, unless you say he's a genius pushing the Marxist agenda, then I'd say he's a genius. But any man who would run his own country off the rails like this, kowtowing to foreign dictators who have to read a litany to you, this is not a smart man. This is not a smart president. Apparently, he's been outmaneuvered by every leader on earth, unless that is his agenda. So you have to assume either he's stupid or he's not a patriot. One or the other, it's not too good for America. And that's why I am talking about this whole issue today of prodigy, genius, this and that, because we never talk about it in the country at all. It's like almost they're like, oh, you can't say that because he's too smart. The other side, you know. No, 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 no. Let's move on. Lauren in Pittsburgh, welcome to the show. What's on your mind, Lauren?
I was just listening to the show, and I just went to college right out of high school. I joked that I never studied after sixth grade. I just finished up my master's with a 3.8, and I would definitely agree as far as my case that the promiscuity with the prodigy definitely fits for me.
But wait, but here's the question. It's not that I want to, like, indulge the audience with your stories of regaling us with your promiscuity. There's enough on the internet. We don't even have to do that. I guess what I'm asking you is, would you think that your lustful nature motivated you or impeded you?
I would say motivated me.
You think it motivated you?
Yes.
No, that's what I'm asking. I'm not here to comment or be a wise guy. Because Henry Miller, as I say, Norman Mailer, rather, said that Henry Miller was, his whole genius was based on lust.
Right. I feel it's helped me be passionate in all different areas of my life, including education, love, anything. I think it's helped with passion.
I understand. So I assume you've never heard the show before. You just were scanning?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're addicted, though, aren't you?
I am. I'm going to be listening.
Well, I'm sending you a free copy of a book written by a genius called Michael Savage. It's called Trickle Up Poverty. Stay on the line. I'll be sending that out to you very shortly on the Savage Nation. Let's take a few other callers in Chicago on WIND. Fernando, go ahead, please. Tell us your story.
Thank you, Mr. Savage. Yes, I'm calling because growing up in Mexico, I had a friend and a classmate, and this guy was so smart that when we were taking algebra, this guy could take any problem from the teacher, and as the teacher was dictating to the class the problem, he would just go working on that problem and finish as fast as the teacher.
So he got to the answer as fast as the teacher. And what happened to him, Fernando?
Well, unfortunately, he discovered alcohol too.
Mm-hmm. So it ruined him.
Well, it didn't ruin his life because he has a decent life, but it ruined his prospect of.
I see. Well, let me send you a copy of TUP, Fernando. I thank you very much. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. Let's fire another call in here. New York, WOR, David, go ahead, please, tell us your story.
Yes, I work with kids in chess, and chess is one of three areas that show prodigy early. It's chess,
yes.
Mathematics, and music.
Right.
And mainly because to be a writer, you have to have a command of the language you're writing in,
yes.
As well as understanding of social situations. Well,
right.
With chess, it's interesting because you could be a prodigy that is far and away above all of your peers, 1 in 10,000, and still not be good enough.
Hmm.
A case in point was a movie done called Searching for Bobby Fischer, where a man by the Mr. Waitzkin wrote about his son, Josh Waitzkin, who was a chess champion, but Josh Waitzkin never got close to the world championship. He ended up going into a completely different field, martial arts.
Huh.
And Bobby Fischer, who was a world champion, reached the pinnacle and then surrendered it at the age of 29 or years old.
David, hold on. I want to hear about your view of children who are prodigies and what happens with them. And then after that, we have a real treat for the audience. We have Henry Miller in his own voice reading from Black Spring.
Savage.
Oive Maria, welcome back to the Savage Nation. I said that jokingly to a friend of mine, a Catholic, last week. I said, Oive Maria. He laughed. He said, well, her name was Miriam, if you read the Bible. It was never Mary. It was Miriam. I said, I didn't know that. He said, well, there's a lot in the we don't know. But I thought that's a nice combo, Oive Maria. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. We're talking about prodigies. geniuses, lust and no lust. And we have on the line from New York on OR, David, who works with kids who are chess geniuses. And I want him to finish up. David, go ahead. So you say a lot of them burn out?
Yes. Eventually, the prodigies compete against each other, and the cream of the cream rises to the top. So kids that aren't used to losing because they're prodigious and winning all the time start getting beat by ones that are even more prodigious, ones that are heading into being grandmasters or world champions. And so the kids that start to lose, they get burned out on it. They've been playing since they were 5 years old. They're now 13 or 14, and they're getting beat.
And what happens to them when they finally lose? You say they go to pieces, or they leave chess altogether?
Every one of them is different. And it really comes down to certain ones, they develop a stronger fighting spirit. I'm going to figure it out, and I'm going to win. Others just simply give up. Others simply decide that they're going to take on another field and use chess for fun as a pastime. It really comes down to an individual personality.
I want to ask you something, David. Working with kids who are great at chess, do any of them function well on marijuana, or does it completely impede their ability?
Well, they're too young. This is between 5 and 12 years old.
Okay, so this is not in California. I'm sorry. In California, they'd be probably mommy would give them the marijuana, the medical marijuana. No, that's a bad joke. So because a lot of people say, oh, I smoke marijuana and I do great. I don't believe that at all. It's called dope for a reason.
I have one last comment that I would just like to add. You're a wonderful writer. I love your books, and I would love to see you come out with a new version of The Political Zoo, especially in this time.
You know, of all my books, that one did not do that well. I think satire is dead in America. People don't even understand satire. I made an awful lot of enemies. I mean, I called guys like Bill O'Reilly the leprechaun. He never forgave me. People never forgave me for that book. I didn't make any friends from it, David. David, let me send you a copy of Trickle Up Poverty. I think you'll enjoy it very much. I mean, I don't want to promote a book, okay, right now, but I got a novel I'm working on, a mystery novel. It's called A Thriller Today. I'm working on it. It's going to be out in July from St. Martin's. I think people's minds are going to be blown, so to speak, in a 60s vernacular by what they read, because the book is set in San Francisco. It's loosely based upon my travails with the UK band. And it's, believe me, it's got a lot of little background in there that's fictional. But let us say that what happened to Mr. Wheeler winds up in the book, okay? And we'll let it go at that. And for those of you who are the 0.1% who know what I'm referring to, you know, the great cybersecurity expert who was found in a landfill 2 weeks ago, and the FBI doesn't release anything. Toxicology hasn't been released. Nobody can believe the West Point graduate wound up in a landfill. And the news business, they don't cover it. Fox News, never heard of it. Nobody heard of the story. The greatest mystery story of our time, completely ignored by the media. Let's go to the callers. This is an opposite caller to the young lady who called earlier from Pittsburgh who said she was really, really, really smart and promiscuous, and she was passionate in everything, and she justified her promiscuity by saying it was passion. This, you're going to hear the opposite side now, I believe, although I don't know. Cambria and Salt Lake, tell us your story. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, I think this is such an interesting subject that you've got today, and you're making an important correlation. I was raised in Salt Lake City, very strict Mormon family, and was always well above average in all subjects. I'm also, you know, have my master's and my CPA, so I don't know if I'm a genius in that respect, but I have not been promiscuous in my life. In fact, I'll just be honest, I'm a 35-year-old woman, and I'm still a virgin, and I know that that's just such a weird thing in today's
society. No, it isn't. What I'm hearing from you is that repression of sexual urges can be used for the betterment of the mind. It could work the other way as well. And I've seen the very same truth, by the way, told in another way. We live in a society that's still built upon the lies of Kinsey, which I've covered on this show before, where he said that repressed sexuality is the worst danger for a person. It'll make you crazy. The kid becomes neurotic. Let it all hang out. They should learn how to master. And you can still be a phenomenal human being. That's what you're trying to say. And I want to add another point. I know very religious people, and they vary all over the map. But the best of the religious people, not the ordinary religious, because you could put on the garb, and you could do the mumbo jumbo, and you could be a rotten human being as well. Or you could not be religious. You know, it varies all over the map. But just because they wear the garb doesn't mean they're very spiritually advanced. They can be just like every other Joe Blow, an ordinary guy, you know, using prostitutes and gambling and all of that. However, the best amongst the very religious that I have met, the saint-like people, have told me that they may have the sexual urges, that is, the promiscuous urges, or the lustful urges, and they said, do you think just we're made of stone? We're not. We feel the same thing the ordinary man feels, but we hold it in. We use it for God. In other words, we repress the sexual promiscuity urges, and we use it for the betterment of ourselves and hopefully for mankind. And I think that's what you are kind of getting at, right, Cambria?
Yes, I think the word repressed has certain negative connotations. I think when you know something is wrong and you resist the urge to do it, it makes you a better human being.
I would think that another way to refer to those urges would be to say to control them rather than repress them. Or you could say sublimate them, and you could put it another way. You could say she puts all of her energy into her work, okay? That's another way to look at it, correct?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Beautiful. I'm sending you a copy of Trickle Up Lust. Stay on the line. 1-800-449-8. That'll be my next book. Trickle Down Lust. Or Trickle Up Lust. That would be a funny book. Someone will steal it by tomorrow morning, I guarantee you. Let's go to Jay, and then we're going to have Henry Miller. Jay in Chicago, go ahead, please fire away.
Well, I'm the son of European Jewish immigrants who barely escaped the beginning of World War II.
Right.
No formal education. I was born with a congenital syndrome that made me look different. I had all these orthopedic problems. A third, I was teased because of how I looked. I had 7 surgeries, a body cast from chin to waist for 8 months.
Oh, my God. So you had a real genetic blow.
Yes. It was, needless to say, it was a challenge throughout life and even till the present. And didn't do well in school for whatever reason.
Right.
But I always did well enough on the standardized test, you know, to continue forward and to go on to the next level.
Right.
Believe it or not, even though a third of the children, more than that, even learning disabled, I managed to go forward. I almost flunked out of college, and then something clicked. I became, I got better grades. I went to law school. I became a lawyer. I became a litigator. And the interesting thing is, my skills as a litigator, the ability to speak and respond, I'm convinced is the result of being made fun of as a kid, because I would always think of responses.
Oh, how brilliant. Well, first of all, you have a superb voice for broadcasting, and nobody would ever suspect that you had any kind of physical impediment whatsoever. I want to say that. You know, radio is a very interesting phenomenon. There's no body, it's all voice. And in that regard, the voice is a better representative of the soul than almost anything else, because sometimes the body deceives us. Isn't that true?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't look how I sound. That's true.
That's what I'm saying. So when you go into court, you disarm a jury, probably.
Well, you know what? They certainly don't think I'm slick and trying to pull the wool over their eyes.
Well, you know, it reminds me, interesting. Remember Clarence Darrow would come in with the rumpled suit? I'm sure you read about that. And the Hayseed Act. And he usually could sway a jury because he wasn't Mr. Slick.
Perhaps. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Jay, that's an amazingly beautiful story. Even though you're a lawyer, I'm going to send you Trickle Up Poverty. No, look, lawyers are a big part of the whole world that we live in, and God knows there's a variety like there are talk show hosts. A special treat for the show. We have to rush right into it. You talk about genius. You talk about lust. You talk about writing. You talk about delivery. To me, Henry Miller in Black Spring, with the book Black Spring, moved me in a way when I had bad periods of my life. I would stay home and I would just read all night long. And one of the books that got me through some of the darkest periods of my life was Black Spring. Now, we're going to play a piece in Henry Miller's own voice, one of the rare recordings, where he reads from Black Spring, where he's taking a relative to a madhouse. Listen to this.
Mealy never knew her way home. And I remember how happy she was whenever she saw me coming. She would say innocently that she wanted to stay with us. Why couldn't she stay with us? I used to ask myself that over and over. Why couldn't they make a place for her by the fire, Let her sit there and dream, if that's what she wanted to do. Why must everybody work, even the saints and the angels? Why must half-wits set a good example? I'm thinking now that after all, it may be good for Mealy where I'm taking her. No more work. Just the same, I'd rather they had made a corner for her somewhere. Walking down the gravel path toward the big gates, Mealy becomes uneasy. Even a puppy knows when it is being carried to a pond to be drowned. Mealy is trembling now. At the gate, they are waiting for us. The gate yawns. Mealy is on the inside. I am on the outside. They are trying to coax her along. They are gentle with her now. They speak to her so gently. But Mealy is terror-stricken. She turns round and runs toward the gate. I'm still standing there. She puts her arms through the bars and clutches my neck. I kiss her tenderly on the forehead. Gently, I unlock her arms. The others are going to take her again. I can't bear seeing that. I must go. I must run. For a full minute, however, I stand and look at her. Her eyes seem to have grown enormous. Two great round eyes, full and black as the night, staring at me uncomprehendingly. No maniac can look that way. No idiot can look that way. Only an angel or a saint. When I ran away from the gate, I stopped beside a high wall and burying my head in my arms against the wall, I sobbed as I had never sobbed since I was a child. Meanwhile, they were giving Mealy a bath and putting her into regulation dress. They parted her hair in the middle, brushed it down flat, and tied it into a knot at the nape of the neck. Thus, no one looks exceptional. All have the same crazy look, whether they are half crazy or three-quarters crazy or just slightly cracked. When you say, "May I have pen and ink to write a letter?" they say yes, and they hand you a broom to sweep the floor. If you pee on the floor absentmindedly, you have to wipe it up. You can sob all you like, but you mustn't violate the rules of the house. A bug house has to be run in orderly fashion, just as any other house. When Mealy stood at the gate with eyes so bright and round, her mind must have traveled back like an express train. Everything must have leaped to her mind at once. Her eyes were so big and bright, as if they saw more than they could comprehend. Bright with terror, and beneath the terror, a limitless confusion. That's what made them so beautifully bright. You have to be crazy to see things so lucidly, so all at once. If you're great, you can stay that way, and people will believe in you, swear by you, turn the world upside down for you. But if you're only partly great, or just a nobody, then what happens to you is lost.
Savage.
Well, you just heard something that you probably never will forget. That was Henry Miller reading from his Black Spring. Of course, he was talking about taking his aunt to a madhouse. In a way that I've never read since or before. It's deeply touching for me for the reasons I've described in some of my writings and on this show. But again, did you hear the simplicity of his language? First of all, I love his voice. That's the one thing I loved most about, in addition to his writing, I'd never heard him. Then I once saw a documentary where Henry Miller's sitting in a pool bobbing around where he wound up living way back in Palos Verdes. Later on in his life, he's bobbing in a pool, and the documentary filmmakers got the camera over the side of the pool, and he's just chatting. And I hear this Brooklyn voice, Henry Miller, and I say, well, God, the guy sounds like a longshoreman. And he was, of course, just a man like that, but he was also a genius. So he wrote with simple prose, yet his descriptions were anything other than the ordinary, right? And, of course, the subject matter was extraordinary. All in a beautiful package, all from Henry Miller, all in Black Spring, and all now on the Savage Nation. Back in a moment.
Savage.
Savage.
a heck of a couple of hours so far in the Savage Nation. I mean, it's, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and you'd expect politics, but I can only do that when there's really a heavy political story. And today, of course, I took a different turn because I went to the event Saturday night, and when I heard this 10-year-old child, this prodigy sing, I said, you know what, I think I'm going to talk about prodigies today. Now, of course, tomorrow we cannot avoid talking about the visit, the state visit of the president of China, because we are in real trouble because we have Chamberlain in the White House, and we have a guy from China coming over who's the president of China, the chairman of the Communist Party as well. Of course, we're not supposed to know any of that. It's a dictatorship, a benign dictatorship to a certain extent, but not quite benign if you're a Christian or a dissenter. It's really a very unbenign nation. We see the high rises, and we realize, oh, they're a real powerhouse. But God forbid someone should protest the fascist dictatorship that is China. You're going to see how the media deals with them, and you'll see that we're living in the Soviet Union. You mark my words. You'll see if there's any protester at all allowed outside the White House. You wait and see what the left-wing geniuses in the media do to them and try how they try to present them. While protesters were once seen as heroes in this country, they are still seen as heroes if they're left-wing and fanatics and communists. They're held up as role models. But if they are in favor of anything religious or Christian or family-oriented or freedom itself, you wait and see how the vermin in the media paint them. You wait, just wait till tomorrow when you see some of them outside the White House gate. So what we'll hear about is what a wonderful president Hu Jintao is, and Obama had served the lobster this and the Chardonnay that. And here we had our weak defense secretary made to look like a gelding last week. He goes over there, and in the middle of his visit, a new stealth plane is unveiled, which can run rings around our own airplanes. And now, on the eve of his visit, Chinese President Hu Jintao declares the dollar is dead, basically, and a thing of the past. You hear this? It's unbelievable to me what this country has become in my lifetime. And in a certain way, I tie it to the educational system, which has failed the nation. I can get very emotional about it, but I don't think I need to. I can make my point without screaming or yelling. The unions have destroyed the schools, and the schools have destroyed the children, and the children who were supposed to be our future, unfortunately, are not very much of the future because they're not very much of the present. The children have become exactly what the left-wing gang has always wanted them to become, incapable of not only defending the nation, but of even seeing that there is a nation. The children don't even know they're living in the United States of America. You take a look at the average white boy, this skinny goofball walking down the street with his pants underneath his behind without a belt on it, aping the lowest of the low, what he has become. And you want to reach out and say, hey, kid, your pants are falling off. But you don't dare say it because you know he wouldn't even understand it. Or he's liable to pull out a gun and shoot you or a knife and stab you. He has no father because the father's been driven out of the home. He has a mother who's afraid of him because she's been told that Johnny's self-esteem might be hurt. If she said, moron, your pants are falling off, you're behind, you look like an idiot. That's the reason the dollar is in decline. That's the reason America's in decline. And that's the reason we have Obama in the White House. It's called the educational system, destroyed by the unions. This is the Savage Nation, another big hour across America. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, the main topic today is China. Is it a friend or a foe? Chinese president, will be welcomed by the lobbyists called our Congress. And this is just after he launched an assault against us, a verbal assault. He blindsided our weak Defense Secretary Gates by unveiling a new stealth plane during his visit to China. And then he announced over the weekend that the United States dollar is passe, a thing of the past in essence, if you can believe this, and that the Chinese currency, the yuan, I affectionately call it the yuan, he said the currency system is a product of the past and that the future of the dollar is questionable. You hear this one? We're also talking about Eisenhower. Many of you don't know who that is. He was a great president, former general. He was the leader of the Allied Supreme Commander, actually, during World War II, president in the 50s. And today is the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell speech, where he warned us against the dangers of the emerging military-industrial complex. Now, I myself am a strong, strong supporter of the U.S. military and weaponry. However, we know that there are contractual problems. We know that there's contractual fraud. We know that there's contractual a lack of contractual oversight, duplication, and things of that nature. And we ask, was Eisenhower right or wrong? And have we learned anything from Eisenhower, or has really America forgotten his words? We're also talking about common sense. You see, over the weekend, I had dinner with Donald Trump. I had a luncheon the following day at my home with Congressman Alan West and his family. And what's amazing to me is how wonderful Congressman West is. What a great family he has. He is a war hero, 22 years in the military. And frankly, we spent most of the lunch talking about the horrible tragedy of Lieutenant Behenna, who's rotting in Leavenworth prison for doing his job in Iraq, all because of political insanity in the U.S. military. And we're trying to raise the public awareness of Lieutenant Behenna. You can read about it on michaelsavage.com, and we'll see if we can get this poor guy out of the brig. Mrs. West told me how bad conditions are at Leavenworth. It's a Civil War-era prison. They cannot even do push-ups in the cell. The cell is so small. Al-Qaeda has far, far better treatment at Guantanamo than our own heroes do, who have been incarcerated by an overly zealous, politically gelded U.S. military at this horrible facility, Leavenworth. While I was at dinner with Donald Trump, said to the crowd that Michael Savage has common sense. Now, what is common sense? A dictionary definition is that common sense is sound and prudent judgment based on a simple perception of the situation of facts. I don't like the word simple, because that implies simpleton. But what does common sense mean to you, really? And I'm asking you, who in the government or the media today do you believe has common sense? Interestingly enough, there was a show at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago that evening. I'm not a big show-goer. I haven't been to one in many, many decades. But at the dinner show, there was a child prodigy, 10 years old, who came out to sing, and I didn't know what to expect. Her name was Jackie Evancho, 10 years old. When she opened up her voice, I was stunned. I thought she was lip-syncing because the voice didn't match the body. 10 years old, the child is a prodigy. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to raise a prodigy, how difficult it would be to keep that child's talent at this level. But we're going to play some more of Jackie Evancho's music because it's unbelievable. And then I've asked you, what's it like to raise a child prodigy? And have you ever known a child prodigy? Aside from their gift, were they different from ordinary children? Well, those are some of the topics today on the Savage Nation, and they're certainly worthy of discussion. There's an awful lot to talk about on the Savage Nation. If you go to michaelsavage.com, you'll see a lot more to discuss. I realize today is a holiday for most people, especially government workers. But here are some of the headlines on my website. China's boss calls dollar a relic of the past. He agrees with George Soros, who said the same thing a month ago. That you won't see in the newspaper. Now, this really irked me. My headline says, Islamists blow a bus killing 19. Okay. Islamists blew up a bus in Pakistan, killed 19 moderate Muslims. Okay? You know what the San Francisco newspaper said? Bus explodes in Pakistan. They made it sound like it was spontaneous combustion. We can never, ever hope to beat the Islamists with the vermin in the media covering for them like this. It's sickening, frankly. It's just sickening. If you go to the bottom of michaelsavage.com, we see all sorts of other stories that you should look at, and I'm not going to read any of them to you because you need to look at them yourself. Just know this. In trickle-up poverty, Michael Savage calls for tariffs on China, as does Donald Trump. See page 305. That's it for the Savage Nation. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255.
Savage.
I'm reading this article now. Asked to comment on reports that Capitol Police and federal agents are asking members of Congress to provide the names of any potential threats they're aware of in their districts, FBI spokesman William Carter commented to Newsmax via email, quote, "Over the last week, law enforcement at all levels has been actively engaging members and staff in Washington, D.C. to ensure all appropriate security precautions are taken in this current threat environment." Emphasis on the words current threat environment. In other words, they've now generalized it. From one mad lunatic who smoked salvia to a broad-based current threat environment. And so now security professionals around the country are breaking down doors in order to protect us. And it's very important. I think that they should create I think that Obama should create a private army right now. I think he should deputize the Black Panthers, for one, who should look for any potential threatening individual and arrest that individual, because the last thing you want is violence. And I think that we should have all of our liberties suspended immediately. You see, just ask Clay Bowler, a grassroots conservative who lives near Springfield, Missouri. On Tuesday, somebody knocked on his door. It turned out to be the FBI. As first reported on a Springfield television station, Bowler was questioned about his exercise of his First Amendment rights and pointed questions he had asked about Rep. Billy Long, who was elected in November to represent Missouri's 7th Congressional District. The agent who visited Bowler this week was accompanied by the sheriff from a neighboring county, Sheriff Jim Arnott of Greene County, Missouri. Now listen to this. Bowler, who questioned Long's conservative bona fides during the campaign, told Newsmax that both the agent and the sheriff told him they had received a complaint from the congressman's office that he had confronted the congressman in a threatening manner. But Bowler said, "I never made any threats to the congressman. I'd never even been disrespectful to the congressman." According to Bowler, who says he videotaped his encounter with the agent and the sheriff Tuesday, both officers told him they were investigating a report of a threat that had come from Representative Long's office, and the Gestapo must get to the bottom of everything in this country, every report, no matter how minor. Bowler, who created an anti-Long blog that he took down after the election, tells Newsmax that the FBI visit was intimidating. He says he believes it was politically motivated as payback for his conservative activities. Fortunately, Bowler said he was able to show a videotape made, blah, 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 blah. Now, there's another indication of a stepped-up government intervention to make sure that there's no violence in the country. As you know, there was a high school wrestling coach, Jacob Volkman, as a mixed martial arts fighter. He was suspended from his job as a high school wrestling coach at White Bear Lake High School in Minnesota because he made a statement about President Obama not too long ago. And the Secret Service came and knocked on his door, and they said to Volkman that you can't say the president is not too bright. And therefore, they suspended him from his teaching job. He has since expressed regret for his remarks. A Palm Springs, California man was arrested Wednesday for making two expletive-laced threatening phone calls in the district of U.S. Rep. Jim McDermott of Washington. He allegedly threatened to kill a congressman, his friends, and his family. Well, that's serious stuff, and they, of course, should be arrested for those kind of threats. But you know what's going to happen. You know that the government's going to overreach. You know that they're going to use this now to suspend civil rights, although they're going to say they're not doing it. You know that right now there's a mass hysteria raging through this country. And you know that the illegitimate vermin on the left are going to use the rampage in a bid to kill talk radio, even though the homicidal maniac who committed the murders in Tucson, according to his own friend, never listened to talk radio. But that doesn't stop Representative Jim Clyburn saying free speech is as free speech does. And Representative Louise Slaughter, the New York, has expressed similar sentiments saying that the FCC is not working anymore. And she said, Democrats and Republicans are really talking about what we can do to cool down the country, SlaughterToldTheHill.com. Part of that has to be what they're hearing over the airwaves. So Representative Slaughter knows more than I do about the First Amendment because she was, I guess she has an inherent knowledge of the First Amendment that I myself don't have. It's true, I've written 25 books, I have a PhD and two master's degrees. I may not have the intelligence level of Representative Louise Slaughter, Democrat, New York. And so I think that we should defer to a representative from a small little district, a Sleepy Hollow district in New York, to tell us what the First Amendment means. I think it's very important that we have civility and decency in speech. In fact, Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, remember him when he was a senator? He said he's going to boycott talk radio appearances and ban all state employees from commenting to talk radio hosts. And then he said that he wants advertisers to stop advertising on our shows. My God, that's quite a jump, isn't it? So there it is. So now there's a jump now from the alleged act of a mentally unstable 22-year-old drug user who smoked marijuana, who smoked salvia, who we're now seeing the government leap in action, and now they're generalizing it, and they're trying to reimpose the unfairness doctrine, the fascist fairness doctrine. And so here we are. We're seeing it happen right away. So there it is. Even Al Sharpton, as you well know, he's an expert on free speech. He's a superbly gifted intellectual. Al Sharpton, one of the most brilliant men in America. He was actually invited to Obama's FCC this week in the aftermath of the shooting incident to pressure the agency to rein in free expression on the airwaves. And that's very important that Al Sharpton be the judge and the referee in this, because although he allegedly stated that a white detective named Pagona smeared a young black lady in feces, which turned out to be a bald-faced lie. And although Al Sharpton allegedly egged on a crowd, we've all forgotten that. In the new America, we forget the past. And all you have to know is that Bill O'Reilly likes him and has him on Fox News. So therefore, he is now the arbiter of what is fair on the airwaves. And I think that, frankly, I think that there'd be a special appointment by the Obama administration of Al Sharpton to oversee talk radio, because nobody knows what polite and kind speech is better than Al Sharpton. And I believe that an analyst like Al Sharpton, who has such a high education and such a fine, fine history of fairness, should be consulted, in fact, should be the new czar, if you want to go to the real level. That I think Al Sharpton should be made Obama's czar of the FCC. Or no, the czar of talk radio. I'm sorry, I was limiting him. I think that Al Sharpton should become the czar of talk radio to make certain that there is fairness on the airwaves. Now, it is true he had his own show that no one listened to, which is, of course, why he's running to a big daddy government to see if somehow he can now become the czar of talk radio and maybe get a gig that way. And so, you know, anything could happen right now. We have to understand that free speech is not free. And we have to understand that some individuals are freer than others to engage in free speech. And at the top of the list would be Al Sharpton. He has the right, he has the credentials, he has the education, he has the background, he has the history, he has the knowledge, he has the superiority of the oppressed. And therefore, I am now electing, I'm actually imploring the government, I'm begging the government to put Al Sharpton in as the czar of talk radio across America, because nobody better typifies moderation in speech than Al Sharpton. We are entering a new dark age, I wrote in 2007, under the dying light of satire, when only the humorless, the drab, and the ignorant will be allowed to speak. But I have good news for you. I have very, very good news for you, because I just read an article from, again, Newsmax. It's very interesting. They're the best on this. I'm going to quote a paragraph. Boston University communication professor Tobe Berkovitz told Newsmax there is absolutely not any reason to link the Tucson rampage to a reconsideration of the merits of the fairness doctrine. Listen to why. The effort to impose fairness on broadcast media, he points out, was based on the scarcity of frequency options available in the age of pre-digital media. Moreover, media content regulation traditionally has relied on the impact on the average viewer or listener, which clearly would not apply to the Tucson suspect. He went on. Now, here's a critical one. All regulation was based on this concept of spectrum scarcity and limited resources, Berkovitz explains. In today's communications marketplace, in fact, there's more scarcity in print than there is over the electronic spectrum, whether it's the number of cable television channels we have, the almost limited number of websites, and blogs, the FM spectrum, streaming audio. So the whole reason for the fairness doctrine has evaporated. Regardless of your politics and whether you think the content is good or bad. Did you hear any of this? He meant the almost unlimited number of websites and blogs, the FM spectrum, streaming audio. So he says the electronic spectrum, spectrum scarcity, which was the original rationale behind the fairness doctrine, no longer exists. There is no spectrum scarcity. And the reason you have a demagogue like Al Sharpton screaming the loudest about, oh, talk radio, you got to ban it, is because he tried his luck at this field and flopped. Nobody listened to him. So now he's gone to his buddies in the Obama administration like some great diplomat, and he's trying to peddle the fairness doctrine because he's jealous of the success of those of us who have more brains and a bigger audience. And you can't let them do this to us. It wouldn't affect me personally. If I was banned from radio, it wouldn't affect me economically one way or the other. I'll tell you right now. I make a very good living, but I'm an older man, and I'm not in this for the money. Let me tell you right now. I am not in this for the money. I'm in it for the valor of the field. I'm in it for the importance of the field. But you will be the loser, liberal and conservative alike, if you let these people win.
Savage.
I like my mama's food, it's so good to me. Her meatballs have the spice that make them taste so nice. A little wine after we dine makes you feel so doggone fine. My mama's a-cooking.
All right, welcome to a Savage Nation. We're talking about a food and a nutrition. And I'm focusing today on ethnic nutrition because many of us take pride in our ethnic background, as we should. And we eat what we think are ethnic meals, but in fact, I'm sorry to tell you, most of the ethnic meals that we're eating are not ethnic meals at all. Example, case in point, Italian food is not really Italian food that the average Italian ate, let's say, 150 years ago in Italy. The Italian diet then was quite sparse. It might have been a whole grain spaghetti or a whole grain noodle on the farm with some vegetables with very little animal protein. And perhaps some cheese products because they didn't kill the animal. But literally, they didn't slaughter the animal every time they ate a meal. And what you're eating is holiday meals three times a day, and you're getting the degenerative diseases associated with overly rich diets. It's the same with almost every other ethnic group on earth. And so you're saying Jewish food. Oh, I'm going to go to the deli and have a corned beef sandwich with a pickle. And that's not Jewish food. That is 19th century holiday Polish food. Jewish food is Yemenite food. You want to really eat Jewish food? Eat a Yemenite diet. That is the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And what the Yemenites eat is what the ancient Israelites probably ate. And that's why some of us wind up with diabetes and heart attacks so young, because we're eating diets that we're not adapted to. Did you know this? You say, oh, come on, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know any of this stuff? Well, I trust my doctor. He tells me to eat what I want and just take Lipitor. And then if I get sick from any food, just take something to digest it. That's all. And if that doesn't work, they'll cut us open and remove something. All right, well, you could live that way if you want. You know what I'm saying? While the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden foods in the etiology of internal health of rational man, I wrote. Page 138 of The Skeptical Nutritionist. I'm a genius. I really am. Boy, I was smart when I was young. That's really a good paragraph. Look at that one. Where the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden in the etiology of internal health of rational man. That's really good stuff. And then I wrote, I support tradition, but urge my religious friends to eliminate dangerous components of their foods developed and introduced long after biblical laws were written. But it's like talking to yourself. You go to a Jewish group, they're sticking their, they're eating Stella d'Oro, they're a cake in their face every 2 minutes, a sweet, they wonder why they have diabetes, and they look so bad at 50-so-many. I'm serious. They've lost all concept of diet. You can't live that way. It's impossible. Some can. It is true. Some people can eat anything. I call them nutritional rogues, by the way. These are the people who you say, oh, my grandfather lived to 104. You're full of crap, Savage, because he ate everything you just said he shouldn't eat, and he drank a bottle of scotch. I said, so he's a nutritional rogue. You try it. Get back to me when you're 50. See how long you last. Right? What else did I want to tell you about? I want to read your paragraph, introduction, why I am a skeptic. Oh, this is an interesting one. I quoted Galileo, who wrote, there is no scientific work that only one man can write. Now, that was written by Galileo in the Middle Ages. Listen to this, Al Gore, you schmuck. Al Gore, schmuck, and every other putz in the academic establishment who said that all the science is in on global warming. Schmucks, idiots. You don't even know what science means, you schmucks. Here's what Galileo wrote, putz. There is no scientific work that only one man can write, schmuck. Galileo wrote that, but Al Gore said, all the science is in on global warming. And then the idiots in the media said, all the science is in on global warming. They're heretics. We know the earth is flat. And anyone who says the earth is round is not a scientist, said Al Gore. And then the schmucks on MSNBC snickered and went, yeah. Introduction, why I am a skeptic. Food is such a personal thing, and how anybody can dare suggest diets for others continually shocks me. And repugnant cuisine is scarcely the road to health and long life, I wrote in 1983. One more paragraph. Let's see. Hey, oh, this is good. Now, there are fine books on becoming vegetarian. Some of my closest friends are vegetarians. That's a joke. Yet we must not seek to declare as an objective truth that the plant world holds our major key to longevity. It may be true that George Bernard Shaw, Tolstoy, Wagner, Shelley, Byron, Thoreau, and other illustrious figures were vegetable eaters, but so was Hitler. In fact, the German dictator's manic depressive mood swings and associated unexpected aggressive outbreaks might easily have been somewhat controlled with a good dose of high-quality protein and unrefined carbohydrates and with a steady intake of a good vitamin mineral supplement on a regular basis. Better, Hitler should have gnawed on a big leg of lamb once a day and had a glass of wine. The well-known photo of Hitler and Eva Braun at Berchtesgaden with the maniac passed out in an armchair after eating lunch is not an image the hypoglycemically attuned researcher is likely to forget, I wrote. Diet and behavior vary in too many people for us to look for a simple set of rules as our salvation from too intense swings of mood. So, I mean, I wrote some nice stuff. You know, Hitler was a vegetarian and didn't drink either. And he was always starving. He could never get enough of anything because he was always hungry, so he invaded one country after another and killed too many people. As I said, if he ate a leg of lamb and had a drink once in a while, the whole course of history would have been altered. It's absolutely true. The book was way ahead of its time. 1981, Macmillan Publishing, out of print. I still own the copyright, so don't rip it off. I think I'll reprint it now. Strategy for Designing a Nutritional Program. As a night, it's a good book. Not for sale. Not for sale. And I want to tell you that the word food fascism, the phrase, I think I coined it on page 6. Food fascism. I was against it then. The bookstores aligned with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, you see, I was against them. And then I wrote, food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselytize. Not wishing to participate in any form of totalitarianism, I wrote, I intend not to dictate a correct diet for a fictional reader. Now, if only Michelle Obama knew that. She dictates to you what you should eat, and then she eats ice cream in Martha's Vineyard. And you're not supposed to notice that. She came back 8 pounds heavier. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The king has no clothes. We're living through it. Every day we see the victory garden that's outside the White House, and then grow your vegetables and eat good, and you're not eating right. They're going to arrest you if your child's obese. Take them away from you. And every time they're on vacation, there they are in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're eating ice cream cones. What the heck? Not good for you to eat like that. Not healthy at all. You know, practice what you preach, my friend. As I said to you last week, it all the roads go back to politics. They all come and go from politics. There's nothing more political than health and nutrition. Look what Obama did to the greatest medical system in the world. So let me read you something that I remember hearing when I was a child. He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Now, what does that catchy rhyme mean? He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Well, it means that if you eat your way, you're getting certain nutrients which are life-giving and longevity-inducing. What is whey? It's the liquid remaining after the milk has been curdled and strained and turned into cheese. There's a liquid that remains, and it's usually discarded, I believe. Now, what's in the stuff that we throw out, called whey? Well, it's rich in so many things, riboflavin, B12, magnesium, potassium, zinc, selenium. So he who plays his fife and eats his whey will live to fife another day. It's the equivalent to eating whole grains as opposed to eating white bread. It's equivalent to eating brown rice as opposed to eating white rice. You know, beriberi was rampant in Asia when they ate white rice until they found out that all of the nutrients that were being thrown out in the husk of the rice were the nutrients required to prevent, for example, rickets. You know, that's an old thing you learned in high school, probably. I don't even know if they teach that anymore. Right now, they give you a pill instead. Everything they tell you to eat garbage, live like a lab rat, and take a pill. And then if you get sick, go to the quack and get six more pills. That's all. But those of us who actually studied foods and what's in them and want to know how to protect ourselves from disease have written books about it. So I remember, for example, there's another thing that's coming back to mind from my great book, 20, 30 years ahead of its time, called The Skeptical Nutritionist. And this was about another topic. If only I could remember it. I'm a little hungover, frankly, from last night. I went to a big dinner, took the dog, and I drank a lot of vodka. I feel great, don't get me wrong. Don't say it's hypocritical. I believe in vodka. But vodka's a health food if you don't do it every night, which I don't. So there was a subject in here that I wanted to find. Oh, I remember. It's fava bean hemolysis. I know that's not on everyone's lips. It's a disease we know nothing about. But I remember when I uncovered it, when I was writing this book, how many doctors wrote me who were ahead of their time. They said, oh my God, Savage, how did you do this? Where'd you find it? Well, I had just gotten my PhD from the University of California, and I was very just fascinated by ethnic diets. And I studied every arcane piece of literature there was, and I came up with some interesting things. And so I found this about fava beans. I've never eaten a fava bean ever since. Now, sometimes if I go in an Italian deli, you see fava beans, and they're fine if you're not, let us say, I shouldn't say allergic to them, but that's close to what I'm about to tell you. There are individuals who do not understand that they lack certain enzymes to break down the fava beans. It's called a G6PD deficiency. I know it's too technical for you, and I don't want to do it to you, but the fact is you get very sick eating fava beans. It's equivalent to acute hemolytic anemia. And you say you don't know what that is. I'm showing you what can happen when you eat certain foods that you're not aware, you're not even able to digest. For example, it's well known that Jews, most blacks, and most Asians cannot digest dairy products directly because they are deficient in the enzyme necessary to break down milk, the milk product known as lactose or milk sugar. Jews, black people, and Asians have very low amounts of lactase, so they are to avoid dairy. Did you know that? So the medical profession, instead of telling Jews, black people, and Asians, don't eat dairy, they tell them, take a pill with some lactate in it. The trick would be to avoid the dairy. Now, why would Jews, blacks, and Asians have evolved or adapted to a low dairy diets? Because there weren't high dairy diets in their traditional environs. There were just not high dairy diets. Basically, there weren't high dairy diets, so they adapted to not eating dairy, and they didn't develop the enzymes necessary to break down milk sugar. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now let's go to you. Many of you believe in raw foods because you're ignoramuses and you think that you're an ant or a rat or some kind of animal in the plains. That's absurd. The fact is that you should eat cooked foods. You're a human being. It doesn't mean you shouldn't eat some vegetables or fruits that aren't cooked. But to think you should eat only raw foods is ludicrous. It's lunacy. It's another part of the folklore of the psychologically deficient liberal to think that raw foods are better for you. It's the equivalent of thinking that a gigantic bird will come from the sky and bring you back to paradise.
Hey, look at all the uncertainty and instability that Obama's creating. It's no wonder the economy is shaky. Gold prices have been going through the roof, and that's why you should contact my great advertisers at Swiss America. Obama might be laying the economy low, but gold is defying that trend. Go to the best name in gold, SwissAmerica.com.
But actually, I want to talk about food instead. And that is the issue of how ethnic foods are very important, both to know what to eat and what not to eat. I'm coming up with something very, very small here. It's called fava bean hemolysis. And there are people who cannot eat fava beans because they lack the correct enzyme to break down fava beans. And what happens is, the urine becomes very dark or red. Shock may develop in bad cases, and death can follow. Did you know that? This condition is caused by a lack of glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. That's an enzyme that breaks down the fava bean. G6PD. You don't have G6PD if you are a Kurd, for example. There are people called the Kurds, as you all know. In the north of Iraq, there's a whole land called Kurdistan. And the Kurds have one of the highest frequencies of this disorder on record. And favism, which I just described, affects individuals with a Mediterranean phenotype. And hemolysis can occur within only a few hours of inhaling even the pollen of fava bean plants, or within 1 or 2 days of eating fresh or dried fava beans. So if you are a Kurd, don't eat fava beans. You say, well, what does it have to do with me? I'm not a Kurd. I don't know. Maybe you are the type of individual who has a Mediterranean background, and you also are deficient in G6PD, and you may have a hemolytic reaction and not even know it. You go to the hospital, you have dark urine, red urine, you have shock, and you don't know it's because you just ate a fava bean salad in an Italian deli. I'm trying to warn you that this kind of knowledge was known back in ancient times, going back to antiquity. As far back as Pythagoras in the 6th century B.C., 6th century before Christ, people were warned that eating this type of bean could yield death. And in the 5th century B.C., Herodotus also mentioned favism. Now, you've forgotten it, though, because we don't know anything about food in this country, of this nature, I mean. All we know is what looks good on a plate. We have geniuses who go to cooking school with pimples on their face, and they come out, as long as they know how to drizzle olive oil on something and put strawberries and raspberries on steak, they think that they're a genius. But in this century, acute hemolytic anemia was reported in 1926 in a Panamanian plantation population. Well, I don't want to go into it because it's too complicated. Maybe you've learned something. But here is another example of the classic one man's meat is another man's poison. And we can all learn from this. And remember not to put down our friends who may find some of our most magical food combinations totally repugnant, because the abhorrence of our favorite food can often reflect a survival instinct which we must learn to respect. Did you like that? This is all from page 29 of The Skeptical Nutritionist, not in print, so I'm not selling you anything, unlike Wallbanger or those who sell floor mats at every turn. I'm giving you information for free because it's important to do. Now, what if you're not of a Kurdish background? I'm going to just read a little bit more to you. You don't want to hear any more about that. Did you know that I can tell you what they studied, Arabs with this and Jews and this and that. I don't think Christians are affected by this at all. I think they can eat anything. I get the feeling the cracker can eat most anything. And that's why they live on mayonnaise, white bread, and scotch. Good genetic stock. They don't worry about G6PD deficiency because they never eat the stuff. They wouldn't be caught dead near a fava bean. Give them a white bread sandwich with mayonnaise and a nice scotch, and that's it. They're happy as a Maasai eating the blood of an ox. I think that's funny. And so I'm making myself laugh. I sound like a nutty professor now. Remember you had professors who would tell a joke that was so arcane only he laughed at it? And you thought he was a genius because he was laughing at something and you didn't understand. I just did that because I did just say something only I understood. A guy told me this who didn't even drink. He survived World War II. He's still alive. And what he told me was every time he had a tinge of a sore throat, he would take scotch and basically gargle it. He would let it sit on the back of his throat and then spit it out. He wouldn't even drink it. He's a teetotaler. He's 85 years old. And you know it works, I swear to God. I mean, I use all the other stuff, the zinc drops, the vitamin C, I got echinacea propolis. It's all good. It all works for me. But I swear to God, they must do something. But tonight, instead of spitting it out, I think I'll swallow it. That's all. I'm going to go right down. In other words, why spit it out? It's 18 years old. The Scotch people, look how hard they worked on it. I'm not a socialist. Why spit out good Scotch? So don't generalize about people who basically have inherited the longevity gene to be a person who lives to 100 or 90. There are people with genes like that. You know that. I'm not one of them. Most of us are not like that. And you certainly shouldn't use the octogenarian's diet as an example of what you should be doing. You would have been dead at 46, some of you. You can't do it. So there are nutritional rogues. It doesn't mean that all the nutritional advice is faulty. It isn't. It is not faulty. It's life-saving. I wouldn't be here if I didn't follow it. I do practice what I preach the best I can. That's all.
Savage.